appeal the separate court of juvenile court of Lancaster County's decision to adjudicate 3A and to terminate her parental rights. I'm asking this court to reverse and remand back. This all started back in the fall of 2011 when my client started a daycare in the purpose of that to stay home with her children. In November of that year, she started caring for a young boy by the name of Zachary, turned one next month in December. And I will come back to some of the events in December, but let's get to January 3rd of 2011, just after the holidays. That morning, his father had dropped him off at the home, approximately 8 place he received him. She noted that he seemed cold and confused. She had already made an appointment for her two young sons. Given it was the holidays, children were sick, she had already made an appointment for her children to go to their regular pediatrician. She woke her husband, who goes to work at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, to care for Zachary while she went off to take her children to the pediatrician. She went, took care of that, picked up some medication, came back around 11:30-ish in that area. Family ate lunch. Helen's husband went to work. And during that time, when she left, she had put the child, who had been getting over an illness, in a swing. When she got back, he was in the swing, asleep. She had lunch, and she and her children basically played in that area. And it wasn't until maybe 3:30 that she talked to her husband on the phone, and he had made a comment back with, wow, feels weird to be back to work after all of this time. She got the sense of time. She immediately went, checked on the boy, found him to be cold, called 911, and began resuscitation efforts. Emergency personnel came. They again attempted resuscitation and took him to deceased. That same day, Ms. Statler met with emergency personnel, explained everything. There's a tape of the 911 call. There's a tape of her being interviewed by two police officers at the scene, one of them. Later on, she went down to the station, and in the early morning hours of the next day, sat and tried to figure out what. The officers came back to her and said, we've talked to our doctor, we've talked to our experts, and this child has suffered a crushed skull. That's what killed the child. Not only did the child suffer a crushed skull, but it happened in your home today, so you must have done it. Maybe your husband did it, maybe you did it. It had to have happened today. That's what our expert is. And she says, I did. This could happen. I did not do this. I would not do this. And that's where this whole thing starts. The state comes and immediately files a motion for temporary custody and a motion to terminate the parental rights along with the petition for the adjudication of 3A. It takes about 2 years for us to get to trial because we're talking about a lot of medical information, a lot of things to unwind. And what we discover over time is that back in December of the month before, month of his birthday, young Zachary had been seen by 4 medical personnel, 3 physicians and 1 physician's assistant. After one night when his mother was giving him a bath, I believe it was on the 16th of December, she noticed what she felt was a lump on the back of his head. They took him to a quick care clinic. Quick care clinic physician who testified at trial said, yeah, they told me what they believed was wrong, but I couldn't, in words he used, I couldn't appreciate this. I couldn't appreciate any mass or any lump. He said, he's got probably got an ear infection. Give him some antibiotics. Well, he continued to have a number of different symptoms, and I think we can all agree that The child probably had an illness, and the child probably was teething. All complications. But they took him to, during the next week or few days, took him to see two different doctors at his pediatrician's, the pediatrician in his office, and physician's assistants in the office. None of them saw that. But in retrospect, at trial, they all agreed that he probably had looked at the symptomology, that this excessive sleeping, increased in sleeping, the nausea, the irritability, and the tenderness on his scalp. Additionally, he had some behaviors where he was pulling his hair. My client had noted that and called the mother and said, pulling his hair? What's going on with that? In the video of his birthday party, he seemed to grab it at his hair and kind of pull towards his ear. And so based on that, there was, I believe, a kind of a consensus among the medical personnel that he very likely had a crushed skull. That also added to the fact that when they performed the autopsy, they looked at the skull fragments, the skull fracture, and that there was ossification, or it was healing. It was healing in a couple of weeks worth of pain. And so we go on to trial, and we have quite a lot of medical testimony, and a lot of it is very conflicting. And the crux of my argument today is that the court improperly terminated my client's parental rights based on the idea that she somehow knew about this or did this. She absolutely has not. She absolutely denies it. She testified at trial. She testified and gave a deposition. She made multiple statements to the officers. And I think that we run into a situation where the law is reason free from passion, and you get into a situation where we worry more about who is popular in court rather than looking at the clinical evidence. And that's why, you know, I objected to the receipt of Exhibit 53. The state initially had Dr. Suzanne Haney testify. She's not a pathologist. Well, she is a pediatrician, but we needed pathologists and we needed neuropathologists to be able to help us unwind what had actually happened. Because we ended up, if you know, the record is replete with the testimony of the argument as to whether or not something called shearing occurred. Now, some of the doctors that testified said they saw shearing. Other doctors said we didn't see shearing. And the problem that we ran into is that we couldn't get a consensus on any of it, or how significant it was. And so what the state attempted to prove was that, just like they had said at the very beginning, it had to have happened in my client's care, and it had to have happened in the way they say. But unfortunately, they keep changing their theory of what happened. And what I suggest to the court is we look at what happened in December as, in a way, kind of a microcosm of what happened later on in trial, where we have a lot of well-intentioned, educated, intelligent people getting it wrong. And then here we have all of these different medical personnel testifying. Now, we get to Exhibit 53, and I objected to that because, unfortunately, Exhibit 53 was authored by Dr. Roger Brumback, who was murdered before the trial. And my objection was, I understand the rules of evidence not applied in this, but due process must be maintained. And for that report to get in, for the court to consider it, for the other basically experts to bolster their positions based on that, I felt that that was error that really went to the heart of the whole issue when we're actually trying to untangle what had happened. And if there's anybody that we could even look at, my client, thousands of pages of visitation notes, she had almost daily visitation with Mitchell for 2 years, demonstrate that she, there's no evidence that she had ever injured her own children or any other child. I think the evidence shows that the children were bonded to her and that it was error to terminate her rights to them. But it's not in their best interest to lose their mother. So I'm out of time, but if there are any questions.
No, thank you. Before you step back, I think you used your rebuttal, but let's find out for sure. Does she have any time left for rebuttal?
No.
I wanted co-counsel or father's counsel to know that.
Be aware.
To be aware of that, so that if he wants to leave any time, he has that option.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sandy Pollack. Kind of puts me in a time bind, I'll do my best. I represent Dan Statler, the father of Gavin and Jordan Statler. I appreciate Ms. Lozano's recitation of the facts. However, as it pertains to my client, while his wife was gone with their kids for the 90 to 120 minutes, he was charged with being responsible for Zachary. As his wife left with her kids, the child was in a swing, rocks back and forth, appeared to be sleeping. Over the course of that 90 to 120 minutes, he indicated to the police officers that Zachary had become fussy. He picked him up from the rocker, patted him on the back, put him back in the rocker. And that was basically what he did with Zachary. Upon returning from the doctor's office, Lacey Statler, his wife, assumed responsibility for Zachary. He went along with what he does on a normal day-to-day basis. Early that afternoon, he left the residence, went to fill a prescription, stopped for a soda, then went to work at Kawasaki. His supervisor testified at trial that upon the beginning of his shift, they all meet as a team, they do some exercises, they figure out what they're doing for the day. During that time period, Mr. Statler appeared to be fine, no indication of being distraught or trauma, until Mr. Statler received a phone call from his wife, finally got a chance to speak with his wife. At that point in time, the supervisor testified that Mr. Statler did become distraught. After arriving home, Daniel Statler was interviewed by a police officer right there in his home. He did not request an attorney, answered the officer's questions. The officer noted that Mr. Statler was distraught and upset. Thereafter, that same evening and going into the early morning hours, he accompanied the lead investigator, Troy Cockle, down to the police station voluntarily without an attorney, answered all of that officer's questions in regards to his dealings with the situation without an attorney, stayed until the wee hours, and then he left. During the entire time speaking with the police officers, he denied any responsibility for this, did not know what happened to young Zachary. As Ms. Lozano noted, the crux of the medical testimony surrounds the shearing injury. If there was a shearing injury, all of the doctors testify that it's basically lights out for Zachary. It's within a very short period of time. If there is shearing, it's lights out. I think that's what the state's position is in regards to this case. It has to, because basically they're saying that either Mr. or Mrs. Statler did something to this child that caused death. There's the one person who put his hands on Zachary's body, Dr. Robert Bowen, the pathologist, testified there was not shearing. He did not see shearing. Defense expert Janice Opphoven came in and testified she did not see shearing in the slides and the rest of the review. State's expert, Dr. Davis, who they retained, said, oh, in my review of the slides and the literature, I saw shearing. Dr. Bowen, the pathologist who put his hands and eyes on young Zachary, did not see the shearing. If there wasn't shearing, then the whole mechanism of the timing of everything really doesn't fall into the state's argument in regards to that my client had something to do with Zachary's death. In order for a juvenile court to assert jurisdiction over children, the state must prove allegations of the petition by a preponderance of the evidence. They have not done so. There's been no evidence that Jordan or Gavin Statler have been neglected in any way. In order to terminate parental rights, the state must prove by clear and convincing evidence that the statutory grounds listed in the sections of the statute have been satisfied and the termination is in the best interest. Parental unfitness means a personal deficiency or incapacity which has prevented or will probably prevent performance of reasonable parental obligations and child rearing, which will cause or probably result in detriment to a child's well-being. There is a basic principle that the right of parents to maintain custody of a child is a natural right. Even if the court affirms the original adjudication, it's not in the best interest of Jordan and Gavin Statler to have their dad's rights terminated. Jordan and Gavin had been out of the home for a long time, with foster parents, with grandma and grandpa. The trial took a long time. There's a lot of complex medical testimony. Throughout the overwhelming amount of visitation notes, I believe it's some 1,600 pages that were submitted to the court that this court's had an opportunity to review. The court can see that the boys are comfortable with their parents. They love and respect their parents. There is no testimony that the parents could not appropriately care for and raise their children. In fact, there's ample evidence to the contrary. Mr. Statler is a loving and engaged parent, well able to care for his boys. I'd ask the court to reverse the trial court.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. My name is Alicia Henderson. I'm from the Lane County Attorney's Office, and I represent the petitioner in this case. Lacey Statler sent a text message to her husband at about 3:30 in the afternoon on January 3rd. It tells us way more than the picture that she has tried to paint and that Daniel Statler tried to paint. She texted her husband, "Zach is still sleeping. I'm going to check his pulse." Now, why is that so remarkable, so indicative of guilt? Well, you have to know a little bit more about this family. Little one-year-old Zachary, at that time, was already dead. He was swinging in a swing where he had been only feet away from Lacey Statler while she was in the living room that day, from afternoon time all the way to 3:30, talking on the phone to her mother, talking on the phone to her friends, with her own children present. It's also remarkable because Daniel Statler really wanted nothing to do with this daycare thing anyway. That was what the testimony was. He wasn't supportive of it. He wasn't interested in her daycare or in her daycare kids. And she sends a text to Daniel Statler when both of them know he's working at Kawasaki. And I learned through the process of this trial that at Kawasaki, they are particular about the kinds of things that you can get away with and the things you can't get away with. And they have a point system. And that point system adds up if you don't show up or if you do something that you're not supposed to do. One of those things is receive texts, send texts, receive phone calls, send phone calls. And we knew from the course of the trial that Daniel was on the edge of having too many points, and so he would be fired. She sends him this text, and he doesn't get it. He sends one back. Eventually, they get a hold of each other and talk. And after that, it takes Daniel Statler 1 hour and 30 minutes to get home. And he texts his friend during that time and says, "Major BS going on." By that time, he knows that little Zachary, one-year-old Zachary, died in the care of his wife, care of him. How's that major? That's a little different picture than the one that both parents tried to portray. On autopsy, the list of injuries that Zachary had was just staggering. He had bruising on his scalp. He had symmetrical bruising on each one of his shoulders, like grip marks, like someone had grabbed him by the shoulders like this. Exhibit number 21 shows at least 10 or 12 pictures of that bruising. He had bruises below his scalp, so once the scalp was peeled back, he had bruises below his scalp. All of these were acute injuries that had occurred within the last 20 hours. There was bruising of the brain itself, and then there was also subdural hemorrhages and a variety of other doctors, Haney and Dr. Davis, both agreed that given the injuries that Zachary had, that he would have been nearly immediately symptomatic, and that anybody who was paying the tiniest bit of attention to him would know. Zachary was in that swing from 9:30 in the morning. Daniel Statler said he picked him up, comforted him, put him back in the swing, and that's where he stayed until 3:30 in the afternoon. He had a dirty diaper during that time, and Lacey Statler was right next to him. Now, when you talk about whether or not the state proved this case or not, In re Chloe L. tells us that if we prove that the parents had control over the child during that period where the abuse or neglect occurred, and there were multiple injuries that would not have occurred in the child's natural movements, that is proving neglect or proving abuse. And we don't have to prove which parent caused that abuse or neglect, says Sarah C. Aggravated circumstances has been defined by this court and the Nebraska Supreme Court as the nature of the abuse must have been so severe or repetitive that to attempt reunification would jeopardize and compromise the safety of the minor children and place them in a position to be re-abused. Now, I submit to you that aggravated circumstances in that definition was put forth before the legislature changed the aggravated circumstances law. It used to only be that it would say that if a parent subjects their child to aggravated circumstances, it was amended in 2002, and that amendment included or another minor child. Thankfully, the legislature saw that there may be situations just like the one that we're in where that notion of someone subjecting a minor child to aggravated circumstances could be reason for a court to terminate parental rights of the parent. I'm going to talk about unfitness and best interest together because really I think that they go together. The trial court made a very specific listing of why she found it to be in the best interest of Gavin and his brother to have their parental rights terminated. She indicated that either one or the other caused the injuries that killed him, that one or the other failed to respond to what would have been immediately obvious symptoms, that they failed to acknowledge responsibility for his death, and that creates a risk of harm to their own children. Without explanation, without acknowledgement of that, how can the trial court eliminate the risk to these two other children? No plan can be developed if you don't acknowledge that you've done something or that there's something to fix. She found that there's no way to correct the problem. Therefore, it is in Gavin and his brother's best interest for parental rights to be terminated. But there's also some other reasons. And the court makes mention of these throughout her opinion. And I thought her opinion was very well written and very well reasoned, not just because it upheld the state's position, but that she really looked at the circumstantial evidence in the case to make a determination of who's telling the truth, who's not, who do we believe, who do we not. During the course of the trial, Daniel got so angry one time that he put his fist through a big screen TV and broke his hand. Now that's bad enough. But both of the parents then, both Lacey and Daniel, lied to the caseworker about what Daniel had done. So we have someone who's willing to, their children are out of the home. They're being accused of killing this child. And he breaks his hand and they lied. Both of them lied to the caseworker. Lacey Statler. We give discovery during the case. And Lacey Statler apparently is reading through the discovery that she has. And she sees that her friend Jacqueline Buchanan, her name is now Jacqueline Quick, she got married. Jacqueline Quick was saying that Lacey had said to Jacqueline that one of her daycare kids fell down the stairs, and that this conversation occurred in December 2011, same week during which the experts believe that that's when Zachary got the injury. Lacey, once she finds out that's what her friend's saying, calls Jacqueline, tries to convince Jacqueline that, no, I didn't really say that. I didn't really say that. You got that wrong. We've got someone who is going to try to influence their best friend to say this didn't really happen. got people who are willing to lie about something that is pretty significant about a temper. We also have Lacey Statler testifying that she was telling the officers that she was more attentive than usual to Zachary that day because he was the only daycare child that she had. More attentive? He's in a swing from 9:30 until 3:30 with a dirty diaper, never fed. There's a whole schedule of what's supposed to happen during daycare. You know, if you take your kids to daycare, you know, at noon we do this, at one we do this. None of those things happen. He was never fed. Never fed, not once during that daytime. She tried to give him some Cheerios. He didn't want them in the morning. That was the end of trying to feed a one-year-old. She never told Elizabeth Taylor and Anthony Taylor, Zachary's parents, that Zachary had fallen down the stairs. Never told them that either. Another text message that tells it all was when Elizabeth sees that bump or feels that bump for the first time in the back of Zachary's head. It turns out to be. And she is so distraught that apparently her husband hears her screaming. I mean, it's like a blood-curdling scream, like, what's wrong with my kid? He comes running upstairs, and she sends a text message to Lacey Statler saying, did Zachary hurt himself, or something to that effect. Lacey's text message back was, if Zach has a bump on his head, he got it in the crib. Elizabeth hadn't texted anything about a bump on a head. So we have another acknowledgement that something happened during daycare. Circumstantial evidence that something horrible happened during daycare. That first had a skull fracture on Zachary, and then later on led to Zachary's death. Exhibit number 53 is the piece of evidence that the defense is complaining that was admitted erroneously, and I would submit to you that exhibit number 53 was the neuropathologist's report. Now, Dr. Bowen was the pathologist, Dr. Brumbeck was the neuropathologist, and Dr. Brumbeck is the man who was murdered between the time he did the report and the time that we went to trial. Now, Dr. Bowen actually brought Dr. Brumbeck in, and they decided together what specimens to take from Zachary's brain. So they decided together that they were going to put certain things on the slide. And it's also important to note that Dr. Ophoven, who was hired by the defense, also had recuts of those very same slides. So she had the exact same evidence that Dr. Brumbeck had and that Dr. Bowen had to be able to make the determinations that she did. So there wasn't anything in Dr. Brumbeck's report that Dr. Ophoven didn't know and couldn't have disputed. But instead, she didn't dispute. There was only one section of Dr. Brumbeck's report where I believed that we did not have sufficient foundation to be able to offer that. And there was a specific section which had to do with some special staining that was done. And Dr. Bowen said, when he testified, I'm not familiar with that process, so I don't believe I can say whether that's true or isn't true. So when I offered Dr. Brumbeck's report, I said, please don't consider that particular part of the report. So that part of the report did not come into evidence. It was the only thing, and Dr. Ophoven herself also said, I don't know how to read that either because that's not something I'm familiar with. Everything else, both of the experts either joined in or saw themselves. So certainly the offer of that report and the receipt of that report was, at the very least, harmless error at this point. Also, the court has already decided in the case of State versus Pruitt that a pathologist could testify about what was in a report that he read since he had relied upon that report. And that's exactly what happened. I would ask that this court uphold the termination of parental rights in this case and find that Gavin and his brother need to remain in foster care and be adopted, hopefully, by people who will take property.
Questions? Thank you very much. The appellants have gone over, is that correct? Thank you. I appreciate you being here today and arguing this important case. Matters deemed submitted, and counsel excused.